Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour audio biography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Mario Gallucci is a high-profile criminal defense lawyer in New York City. He's known for representing very controversial clients, like a dental surgeon who made millions of dollars harvesting and selling body parts, including the human remains for the late host of Masterpiece Theater, Alistair Cook. Gallucci is a legal analyst on the New York One cable news station and has his own reality television show, Partners in Crime, on the USA Network, a lighthearted look on the life of criminal lawyers. He's also a former assistant district attorney on Staten Island. His Twitter handle, of course, is Mr. Acquittal. Mr. Acquittal, welcome.
How are you, Alan?
I'm good. You know, it's not easy getting a client acquitted, especially if the public has decided that your client, and it happens a lot to you, it seems, doesn't deserve a fair trial.
It's probably one of the most difficult things to do is to get a client acquitted in a criminal trial. Juries, for the most part, have read about cases. And in this day and age where we have Facebook and Twitter and all of these other media outlets, it becomes more and more difficult to have jurors keep a straight and narrow look at cases.
So how do you even it out?
I do my best to try to tell them that they shouldn't be looking at any of that stuff, not believe what they read, that how would they feel if it was their loved one sitting in the chair next to me? What kind of juror would they want to be judging them? Or if they were sitting in the chair next to me? You know, being a criminal defense attorney, you deal with a lot of very good people that sometimes just get caught in very bad situations. And you try to make the people on a jury recognize that.
Give me an example.
A DWI, somebody who's never done anything wrong in their life. They're a hardworking person. They're in their 40s or 50s. They've had a career. They've had children. And one day they go out to dinner with their wife. They have a couple of glasses of wine with dinner. They don't recognize that they're, you know, intoxicated because, you know, it's a bottle of wine between a husband and a wife. They get in the car. After a lovely dinner, they drive home. They get in a car accident, and in the car accident, somebody dies. Well, there's a person that never intended on hurting anybody. There's a person that probably thought that they were sober enough to drink and drive, and a bottle of wine. But a bottle of wine, believe it or not, could put you right over that limit and put you in a very bad situation.
But so, we should know better, shouldn't we?
We should. We should. But it doesn't always happen. So I said there's a lot of good people that sometimes put themselves in some very bad situations.
And that happened to you a number of times?
Me? No, I've never.
No. I mean, you've represented those kind of clients.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All the time.
You know, how do they know to come to you?
I've got a very good reputation. I'm pretty well known in the bar in New York. I have a practice also in Jersey that I'm pretty well known in. Former prosecutor, so people remember me from being a prosecutor. Been doing this for 26 years as a criminal attorney.
But DWI means that they've already decided that you're guilty. Is that's the impression of the jury has? Or?
Well, DWIs, I always say, are probably one of the easiest cases to try if you do not have a victim. And the reason why is but for the grace of God, you will generally find somebody on that jury who's had a couple of drinks and gotten behind the wheel of a car, and they can comport. What's the word I'm looking for? They can
identify
themselves.
A nice word.
With the defendant.
A little empathy.
Yes, absolutely.
You had probably one of the highest profile cases on the East Coast ever.
Which one?
Oh. Which one? I think how about Michael Mastromani?
Oh, Mastromarino.
Mastromarino. Pardon me, I'm sorry. We lost him too, but
yes.
I don't think I could ever explain what he did and why he did it. And I don't think I've, all the things that I've read about it, only get small pieces of what happened. Tell us a story.
Well, Michael Mastromarino was an oral surgeon who unfortunately lost his license to do oral surgery because he became addicted to painkillers from an old football injury. After he rehabilitated himself and became sober, he recognized that in order to maintain his sobriety, he needed to find a job where he could use his surgical skills. So he turned to the tissue harvesting business.
Which means?
Well, you know, when people die in a hospital, their skin, they can get a skin graft, they could give tendons, they could give ligaments, all of which could be used for people in the future. You know, somebody has a surgery, they need, a burn victim may need a skin graft. Somebody needs a dental implant. It can come from the bone of a donor person. And that's what he was doing. And quickly, what he recognized was most people don't die in the hospital. There's a whole population of people that die in a home and go to a funeral parlor, and those people aren't able to give their tendons and tissue and bone to the population. So he went to the FDA, and he got permission to do funeral parlor extractions.
Food and Drug Administration.
Yes. And as a result of that, they gave him permission with certain standards and requirements. The first standard was that he needed to get permission from the people that he was going to be harvesting the tissue from. And then he needed to harvest tissue from people who were not sick, that didn't die from disease, we'll say. You know, nobody who had syphilis or AIDS. And what he would do is he would set up that protocol and he would harvest the tissue and he would send it to one of the many tissue harvesting companies in the country.
Harvesting. What exactly did he do when it was legal? Before we get to why it became illegal in his case.
Well, to harvest his own, he would be able to use his own surgical technique. He would be able to take a cadaver and take a skin graft, for example, a large portion of skin. He would use surgical technique to take a large portion of skin. He would store it appropriately and then send it to a skin graft company.
How did he get the cadaver?
The cadaver would be at the funeral parlor, and he would have funeral directors who would talk to the loved ones about whether or not they wanted to make a donation. Sort of like when people are in a hospital and they have a kidney and they come to them and they say, would you like to donate the kidney of your loved one?
So it was a good, it was a feel-good situation for a while.
Oh, it was an absolute, he had all good intentions.
And then?
And then he figured out very quickly that he believed that the FDA was wrong and they didn't need to be disease-free because all of the tissue would become irradiated. And that he would actually make more money if he didn't have to get everybody's permission to do it. And who would know whether their loved one was pillaged or not because they were going to be buried or cremated anyway.
He claimed he made $4 million in 4 years. Is that right?
I would say at least $4 million in 4 years.
Good harvest.
He had a team of people in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York.
And then what happened?
Well, then what happened is one day he got a subpoena to turn over some of his records, and he came into my office with the subpoena, and he looked at me, and he said, what do I do with this? And I said to him, what is this? And he explained to me what I just explained to you. And I said, that's legal? You're allowed to go to a funeral parlor and take people's bone and tissue and ligaments, tendons? And he said, oh, absolutely. Here's the protocol. Here's the FDA stuff. So I go, all right, well, you got to answer the subpoena. Josh Handshaft was the assistant DA.
And what did the subpoena say?
It said that we need all of your records with regard to this harvesting business that you're running out of a Brooklyn funeral parlor. So he comes into my office 2 days later with about 6 inches worth of paperwork. And I take the paperwork. I make a copy. I send it to Mr. Handshaft over in the King's District Attorney's office. And he calls me back, Mr. Handshaft, and says, what's this? And I said, those are the records. He goes, Mr. Handshaft said to me, I expected room full of records. You sent me 6 inches. Talk to your client again. Have another conversation with him because he's not telling you the truth. So I had Dr. Mastromarino come into the office.
And he was an oral surgeon, a dental surgeon.
Yep, and he came, maxillofacial surgeon. And he came into the office with a few more records, maybe a foot of records. And then the games began. Turned them over, and next thing we know, he was indicted. When he was indicted, it was a huge media frenzy.
Indicted for what?
He was indicted for a conspiracy. He was indicted for a scheme to defraud. He was indicted for assault. He was indicted for enterprise corruption. That was the biggest count because he set up this enterprise that was doing illegal activities in a number of different states.
And then he was eventually pleaded guilty, did he not?
On the day of trial, he pled guilty.
How'd you feel about that? I mean, you spent all that time getting ready for a trial, and you felt he was innocent. He wouldn't be spending that much time trying to defend him, I'm guessing.
What happens when you're a criminal defense attorney is you learn very quickly that your clients may not always be telling you the truth. So you don't always rely on what they're telling you, and you rely on the Constitution. So a lot of what a defense attorney does is defend the Constitution, and by defending the Constitution, you are defending your client.
How'd you feel about his pleading guilty?
It was upsetting to realize that through the whole entire time that this was going on, that on every step of the way he had lied to me and he had lied to his family, because we could have done something with this a lot earlier in the case that would not have resulted in him getting the type of sentence he got.
18 to 54 years, and eventually he died. That was in 2013.
Yep.
Cancer, bone cancer.
Bone cancer. He had cancer in his groin that metastasized immediately into his bones.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. Our guest is the flamboyant defense lawyer Mario F. Gallucci. Do you have any idea when you were playing second base from Monsignor Farrell High School in Staten Island that you would be or might be the second coming of the Lincoln lawyer of Matthew McConaughey fame? What do you think?
I had no idea I was going to become a lawyer until my college roommates behind my back sent in a seat for me to take the LSAT exams. And when I opened up the mail one day in college and I saw a seat with my name on it and I asked them, what's this? They had all taken a vote and decided when Mario grows up, he should be a lawyer. And that's how I became a lawyer.
And Mario grew up. But you wound up Vermont Law School, South Royalton, Vermont. Nobody lives there except birds.
And me.
And you. Why'd you go there? Why not New York?
I went to law school in Vermont because at the time I graduated college, all of my childhood friends had graduated college. And they all had jobs on Wall Street. And at the time, in the late 80s, early 90s, they were all making money and they all had expense accounts. And I knew.
Deep
in my heart. That it would be very difficult for me to take my studies very seriously here in New York, and instead I would probably be going out every night on somebody's expense account. So I decided to go to Vermont Law School, and I figured nobody would visit me, and I would get my work done, and I fell in love with the place. It was just beautiful. The people were beautiful. The school itself was just a fantastic place to learn. They just didn't encourage the whole environment at a law school just encouraged you to think outside the box. The faculty was wonderful. Student body was wonderful. The town is probably as big as a studio.
And you learned something called the rules of evidence there, did you not?
Oh, yes. The rules of evidence. I learned that there are no rules of evidence. The rules of evidence get dictated on the day of each individual trial.
What are the rules of evidence supposed to be?
Well, there's a whole book on the rules of evidence. Richardson's on evidence is it's probably a 1,000-page volume on what you can do and what you can't do. But I learned very quickly in law school that the rules of evidence mean you try to do whatever you can do and wait for the other guy to say you can't.
You're known to be very flamboyant, and you're also known for using the media to get your way. You're smiling. They can't see that. This is radio. How do you do that? How do you use us?
Well, I don't know if I use you.
Sure, I know you do.
I know that the media is one tool that I have in my chest. The media is always intimately related to a lot of the cases I have. They are always looking for quotes, and I try to give quotes that are appropriate for the case, while taking into consideration the respect of the potential victims.
I kind of suspect – I've looked at the list of clients that you have. It's quite controversial group of lists. And reporters probably can't stand you half the time.
I have a very good
– Do you?
I have a very good relationship with most reporters.
But your wife, who's a teacher, and you have three children?
I have three children.
Three children. I would expect that some of these cases kind of filter to New Jersey where you live.
They
in
do.
Marlboro, New Jersey.
They do. They do. I get stopped by a lot of people. My wife doesn't read the papers half the time.
Why?
She's embarrassed. She doesn't want people to know.
She doesn't tell people she's married to you?
She tries to deny it on many occasions. She tried to deny it. My daughter, who's up at Binghamton, also tries to downplay Dad's criminal defense side.
Why is that? Why are criminal defense attorneys so, I don't know, just hated or despised or misunderstood? I'm not sure which of those fit.
I would say we're misunderstood. The first thing people do in the morning when they wake up is they open up a newspaper, they turn on a radio, or they turn on a television set, and they want to hear what's sexy. And what generally is sexy is either Kim Kardashian's taking her clothes off or there's some crime that they want to read about. That's the first thing people do in the morning. So when you see a criminal defense attorney, the first thing they think to themselves is, oh, here's this guy who's going to try to get this bad guy off. What they don't recognize
is— The bad guy is already a bad guy. Even before you get to trial, before there's an indictment, before, if anything, he's a bad guy.
Bad guy from the—
And you're a bad guy for representing him.
Absolutely. That's the way they think.
And you've read the Constitution, I assume.
Oh, yeah. I've read the Constitution.
The Bill of Rights.
I actually quoted the Constitution today.
Did you?
Yeah, the Confrontation Clause.
Well, let's hear it.
Well, I have a client that's on trial as we sit here now for a double homicide, a murder one, and the district attorney's office in Richmond County wants him to testify, wants witnesses to testify with fake names so they become anonymous in the record itself. And today we took arguments. We don't have a decision yet, but we took arguments on whether or not the judge is going to allow them to do that. They made arguments that were under a protective order, so I don't know what their arguments were.
So you're going to have witnesses who will be unidentified?
Unidentified. They'll be live in front of a jury, but they'll be called Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones, Mr. X, Mr. Y.
And the problem with that is— Constitutionally,
I believe that my client has the right to confront Mr. whoever he really is.
Sixth Amendment.
Yep, Sixth Amendment. Very good, Mr. Walper. Yes.
I'm proud of me.
Yep, yeah. Sixth Amendment. Right to confrontation.
People don't know anything about the Bill of Rights, do they?
Most people don't know anything about the Bill of Rights.
So when you're going to trial, you have to teach them a little bit about the Bill of Rights?
Well, what you try to do is you try to identify jurors or potential jurors who recognize that this country is great because of the Bill of Rights and because you're entitled to an attorney and because you are entitled to your rights, not like any other country. That's what makes this country great. So I make sure I have jurors that appreciate that.
How do you know?
Trial and error.
You're looking at a juror and you know?
It depends on the judge. Some judges will allow you plenty of opportunity, ample opportunity to I love jury selection, first of all. Jury selection is probably what I consider the most important part of a trial.
You know, I've never been picked for a jury. I got as far as sitting in one of those things, and then the judge looked at all of us. There were about six of us, and said, "Any of you watch Law and Order?" And we raised our hands, and I was gone.
See, I would use you. I would use you
because
when you put your hand up. I would say, "You watch Law and Order, right?" And
yeah.
And when you watched Law and Order, and you watched the defense attorney at work, did you have any feelings for that man? And then how would you respond to that, Alan?
I don't know. I'd wait for the commercial. I'm not really sure. I don't know how you the three or four times when they know you're a reporter, there's a fear. Some judges want you on and some judges don't want you on.
Right.
Some prosecutors are not really sure. And in one case, I was sure that I was kicked off because I was a reporter.
I would keep you.
All right. Thank you. The next time I'll remember
yes.
that.
That's Tell me the, when you're serving next.
Okay. Well, I don't know. That's the courtroom voice of Mario F. Gallucci, a former assistant district attorney in Richmond County, which happens to be Staten Island, who uses his prosecutorial skills on behalf of people accused of breaking the law. Now, there's always cases that you never forget. And there's one case I want to discuss with you, the one in which a young woman accused an actor by the name of Christopher Tardio of biting her and leaving some very, very indelible marks. Tell us that story.
Well, Mr. Tardio was acquitted of those crimes, so he was found not guilty of those crimes. But it was the last case as a prosecutor that I tried. Mr. Tardio was allegedly in a bar on Staten Island that a riot broke out in, and during the riot, Ms. Gutch, who was a police officer at the time.
She was off duty.
No, I believe she was on duty.
She was on duty.
She was on duty. Arrived at that bar where there was a melee happening, and she got injured. Her fingers were bitten, and as a result of that, she lost, I think, three fingers on her hand, and Mr. Tardio was charged with that. And my last trial as a prosecutor, Mr. Tardio was acquitted of that crime.
But before you got there, there was a series of incidents which really fascinated me. So share them.
Well, in the beginning, the attorney for Mr. Tardio refused to take any offer.
And you're a prosecutor now. I want to make sure everybody understands that.
So I'm prosecuting, and I think the original offer might have been probation, and it was refused. And then during the trial, they came to me and wanted the probation offer back. And I said, no, I refused to give it back because now I believed in my heart, we've started the trial. When I gave you the offer of probation, my case was somewhat strong. But now that I've seen some of the trial go, I was more confident in my case. So I offered a minimal amount of jail time.
Which was?
I think it was 1 to 3 years.
Okay.
We're going back a very long time. And the defense attorney refused that offer. And go forward a few more days in trial, and the defense attorney comes to me again, and he wants the offer, I believe it was 1 to 3. And I said, my case is even stronger at this point.
So now you don't want to give him that plea bargain?
No, so now I'm going to give him 2 to 6.
2 to 6 years in prison.
Yes, and that was refused also. He said, I'm not taking that. So the trial went a couple more days, came back to me, and he said, you know what, maybe we'll take that offer. So I said, oh, no, Mr. Defense Attorney. Now the offer's 3 to 9 because I have a I've seen it all now, and I have a very strong case.
Which means that he can't get out before 3 years, any kind of parole.
You got it.
Okay, and then now what? Now it's getting really serious.
Now he turns that down, and the jury's I believe the jury began deliberations, and he came to me and asked if he could have that offer.
The 3 to 9?
Yep. And Bill Murphy, who was, God rest his soul, was the district attorney, I went to Mr. Murphy, and Mr. Murphy said, that's not a decision either one of us can make. That's a decision that you need to speak to your victim about and see if she's willing to take it. And at that moment, she said, you know what? I've come this far. It's not about the amount of time he gets to me. It's more about a jury finding him guilty for what he did.
And he mentioned something. Didn't Murphy mention something about how many fingers she had left?
Yep.
She'd lost
two
fingers?
Yep.
So she's there with three fingers, and she wants to finger him forever.
Yep. She wants that guilty. She wants that word guilty. So we let the jury deliberate, and they came back. And, of course, Mr. Tardio was acquitted. He was found not guilty by a jury of his peers. And that was the last case I tried as a prosecutor.
Well, how'd you feel about that?
I did not like it. I was upset by it. But you know what? In hindsight, although I loved Eileen and she's a great person, Mr. Tardio ended up becoming a very successful person.
Actor.
Yep. Never, ever,
actually,
ever.
Wasn't he on a couple of Law & Order episodes?
Absolutely, yeah. He's never in trouble again.
Do you take these cases home with you, whether you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney?
Yeah, I got 3 hours of sleep last night.
3 hours of sleep you were worried about losing the case?
No, 3 hours of sleep because you're thinking. So I fell asleep. I fell asleep about 10 o'clock, and I was up at 1:44. I woke up thinking about the trial I'm on. We're about to start jury selection. I was trying to think about some jury questions, and I guess it was in my mind. I woke up, and my wife is used to it. I get up, and I just go somewhere in the house and playing around with a laptop until I'm tired again. And I think I walked back into the room about 4:30 and then fell back to sleep and woke up at 5:17 and went to the gym.
I assume it's pretty difficult to deal with someone who's found guilty that you sure is innocent.
That happens. You know, I just tried a case over the summer, a 7-week murder trial, and my client was found guilty in that case, and I believe strongly in his innocence.
What was that person tried with and convicted of?
He was tried for murder and convicted of murder.
And you believe to this day that he was innocent?
Right to this moment.
Will there be an appeal?
There is an appeal. There's an appeal going on. I don't do appellate work, but there is an appeal going on.
Well, then do you feel like maybe you should have done more?
No, I think I did a good job. I just don't think the jury got it right, to be honest with you. I think that the jury really didn't put one and one and one together the way they should have put one and one together. And instead, this was a very high-profile case.
What happened?
What it affects the case?
Quickly.
Affects the case quickly is my client comes home from work and he finds his wife stabbed to death on the kitchen floor. He begins to scream and yell. Calls 911, reports the murder, calls his mother-in-law, calls his parents, and police come, and for months they investigate. It was so not clear that his mother-in-law and father-in-law actually took him into their home after the murder and housed him for a number of weeks until they started to think that maybe he was the person that did it. And that's when they asked him to leave and maybe go live with his own parents.
So you're going to sleep on that one for a long time.
I'm still sleeping on that one.
But you did everything you could.
I know I did everything I could.
Does he believe you did everything you could?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what about the prosecutor on the other side?
Oh, she's great. Wanda de Oliveira. She's one of a kind. I've tried.
So she believes strongly in his guilt, just as you believe strongly in his innocence.
She believes he's absolutely guilty and can't understand how I think he's not guilty.
And you've discussed this with her?
Absolutely, all the time.
So you discuss these kinds of things with the prosecutor after a case is done?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very good rapport with most prosecutors.
Because you were a prosecutor?
Not only that, but I treat people fairly. I treat people the same way I want to be treated. You know, that's one of the things I strongly believe in success is to treat people the way you want to be treated. I mean, although I'm in an adversarial system.
Certainly are.
There is no reason to be adversarial when you're not in that system. So when I'm not in a trial or a hearing or a plea bargain session or something like that, there's no reason why we can't be friends. We can't talk. I'm friends with a lot of prosecutors.
Well, you were one.
Yes, I was.
Mario F. Gallucci. What does F stand for?
Francis. Frank.
Francis Gallucci. Defense attorney, or as he's known to his Twitter followers.
Mr. Acquittal.
Mr. Acquittal. We should have a little shout out to your wife who gave you that name, right?
Yes, the lovely Christine gave me that name, Mr. Acquittal.
Thanks for sharing your legal and personal life with us.
Thank you.
Joanna Wolpe is the senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is the executive producer. Conrad Sanguinetti is our engineer. You can listen to any of our growing list of autobiographies by Googling Conversations with Alan Wolper. You can even follow us on Twitter. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.